Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
For the 30,000 men and women preparing for deployment to Afghanistan, New Year's Day is bittersweet. And for their families at home, the long wait begins soon.
Every night she sleeps alone. And by her bed she puts the phone.
The surge begins and ends in 2010. Soldiers head off, hoping to return for good in 6 months.
He might call her from the road just in time to say hello. And goodbye.
Hello and goodbye for the new year on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning and Happy New Year. It is the first day of 2010, a fresh new decade. All things are possible, Luke Burbank. Luke Burbank is here, still filling in for us for one more day. John Hockenberry returns on Monday.
Let's get right to the top stories that we are following on this fresh new morning. New Year's in Times Square, where 10,000 handwritten wishes were fluttered down with the confetti when that ball dropped. Many Americans say they're hoping for a fresh start as we ring in this new decade.
And we thought it would be a good idea to check back in on a family that has had a tough 2009 and possibly a tougher 2010. Russell Galletti, we've spoken to you before. You're a first lieutenant in the Ohio National Guard, and you're soon deploying to Afghanistan within a month's time. Do you know when you leave, Russell?
I'll go back to Hungary to meet with my Hungarian partners in a few days here, and then in a few more weeks we'll head off to Afghanistan.
So New Year's takes on kind of a different flavor for you, right? It's a little bittersweet.
Yeah, it's more of a goodbye than a kind of a welcoming a new year, saying goodbye to my wife and family and home, but saying hello to a totally different kind of job.
How about the celebration at home? Has that been a little bit muted?
It's been, hello and goodbye because I've been gone for so many months training, but I'm back, but then I'm getting ready to leave again. So mixed feelings all around for everybody, I think.
Okay, Russell Galletti, stay with us. We're going to go back to you in just a few minutes to talk to you and your wife about 2010, but now more on the top stories.
A federal judge has thrown out the indictment of five former Blackwater security guards over a shooting in Baghdad 2 years ago that left 17 Iraqis dead. They were accused of firing into a crowd of civilians, but the judge found the government improperly used evidence to build its case. In Pakistan, police say they plan to seek life sentences against five Americans arrested for suspected terrorism last month. The Washington, D.C. area men reportedly were on their way to join militant groups. And across the border in Afghanistan, we're learning more about how a suicide bomber infiltrated a U.S. base, killing seven CIA employees. Officials tell the AP the bomber was invited to the base and was not searched since he was being courted as an informant.
Back at home, President Obama has summoned intelligence and homeland security chiefs to the White House for a meeting on Tuesday. They'll go over the security breakdown leading up to the terrorism attempt on Christmas Day. And here's a New Year's message from the president.
Although our challenges are great, each of us has the courage and determination to rise up and meet them. It's that spirit that has kept the American dream alive for generations. And it is that spirit that will keep it alive for generations to come.
Wall Street is closed for the day, for the holiday, and actually it closed out 2009 at a loss, but the stocks still managed to have their best year since 2003.
Coming up, it was a huge blockbuster holiday season for movies.
Records
being set. Avatar, just, by the way, you got to see that in 3D, America. If you're going to see that movie, do it in 3D. We're wondering, though, are there similar blockbusters out there in the 2010 horizon? Well, Rafer Guzman from Newsday will be here to tell us about that in just a few moments.
And if you've made your New Year resolution, we're asking, how do you plan on sticking to it? Post-it notes, how do you remember to keep yourself in line? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're looking for your tips. In just a few moments, we'll speak some more with the Galettis. Good morning. morning. I'm Celeste Headley. Happy New Year. I'm joined this week by Luke Burbank, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. John will return on Monday. 30,000 U.S. troops will deploy to Afghanistan this year as part of the U.S. surge. We have one of those troops with us here today. It's the very first day of 2010. So many families are looking to make a fresh start in the new year, but we wanted to check in with two friends of The Takeaway, husband and wife Russell and Mary Galletti, as they prepare for Russell's deployment to Afghanistan at the end of this month. They join us from Cleveland, Ohio. Russell, you talked earlier about how this is kind of a hello and goodbye for you, but you personally, in addition to leaving your family, you're also preparing to go to war.
Yes, I am. We've been preparing for several months, so I'm kind of starting to separate the professional side from the family side of me, and once I get in theater and with my troops, I'm kind of a different person, and that really helps cope with the absence.
How does that transition work, that transition from being a husband and being among your family and moving into the professional soldier stance?
Well, I think everyone goes through that every day when they, grab their coffee and head into their office and read the paper and start catching up on emails. Ours is just a little more intense and requires, it's almost a... kind of method acting.
No, nobody's shooting at me at my office, Russell.
Well, you're lucky.
Mary, how about you? You're getting ready to move from being a wife to being a wife with an absent husband.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an entirely new feeling. We spent our engagement with him deployed to Iraq and have been apart the last 6 months. It's kind of neat because we got married young, so it's given me an opportunity to think about living on my own and what that experience would be like, but not having sort of all the other hassles, still having a partner, even if he is far away.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the change here, because your first deployment is its own animal, right? I mean, you don't really know what to expect. You're not really sure what the problems are going to be or how hard it's going to be while he's away. Now you're going into another deployment where you know what it's going to be like. Is that make it easier or harder?
It's weirdly harder, and I think it's mostly for two reasons. The first is that we've been together longer. We've been married now for 4.5 years, and we have a rhythm to our life and to our marriage. And when he's gone, that disrupts the rhythm. And you just get used to having someone around, and then they're not around, and you have to sort of adjust. And then they come back, and they're different, and you're different, and you have to adjust again. And so in that way, it's definitely harder. I think it's also harder because during the first deployment, it was really easy for him to leave out sort of crucial details and really easy for me to avoid, CNN or avoid news reports that would have otherwise stressed me out. I think having had the experience and knowing more of the details now allows my imagination to sort of run away with me from time to time. So in that way, I think it's a little bit more stressful. But it's also, in this case, it's a different country. It's a different experience. It's a different job. And he's in a different role. So I'm just working on deluding myself that way.
So do you stop watching the news when he leaves?
Almost entirely. I think you end up hearing these vague reports of, 4 U.S. soldiers injured in vague area Afghanistan. And it becomes very easy to start convincing yourself that yours is one of them. And you start looking for the ominous vehicle out in your driveway coming to report bad news. So it's just a little easier to exist in a bit of ignorance at that point, I think.
Russell, how does it feel for you when you hear your wife saying that she can't even bear to watch the news because she would imagine that you're among one of the injured or dead?
It's very tough. And she is a fantastic wife. For everything that she does put up with, because I'm not only gone, and no soldier's or service member's wife or family, it's not just the deployments, but it's also several months away from home for schools or floats if you're in the Navy or Marine Corps. So everyone, military families definitely do deserve the praise and the respect that they get from all corners of society, because they do. And, my wife does put up with quite a bit as far as absence goes. And I think every soldier on my team, there are wives and there are mothers and girlfriends and friends who feel those fears. So it's just kind of a shared hardship among not only the families and friends of the service members, but also the service members. And and we just all kind of bear it together, I guess.
Do you have a different feeling about your mission from your last deployment when you were engaged and you went to Iraq? Do you feel maybe less strong in this strategy going into Afghanistan? Or are you optimistic about the surge strategy there?
Oh, I'm quite optimistic. The attention that has been given to counterinsurgency in the training that we've experienced in the couple of months leading up to this, very optimistic and very excited to kind of dig in and get down to work and build rapport with our Afghan National Army counterparts. Our job is so much different than it was in Iraq. In Iraq, we were offensive, defensive, convoy security. In Afghanistan, this is just true counterinsurgency and combat advising at its best.
What do you think, Mary? Are you kind of feeling positive, as your husband is, about the surge strategy in Afghanistan?
I think so. I think this is one of the first times that an army or a military force has really thought about the cultural implications of what they're doing and how to be most culturally sensitive and subsequently effective. You know, we keep hearing the buzz phrase is winning the hearts and minds. And this is, I think, the first time that the military has really thought about what that means and how to implement it. And in particular, I would probably note that in a lot of cases, folks like the National Guard and the reservists are a little bit better at that than active duty oftentimes because they have a little bit more life experience. They're a little bit more calm than some of their very young counterparts.
You know, Mary, you might have heard your husband saying earlier that the holidays for him have been bittersweet because they've been hello and goodbye as he comes home from training and then gets ready to deploy. And I'm wondering if for you, 2010 is like goodbye and hello. Because at the same time that you're preparing for him to deploy, maybe you're counting down the days till he comes home in 6 months safe and sound.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting. A bunch of us, of the families who have soldiers going over with this particular group, were together last Saturday for a wedding, and we were talking about what the next part of the year is going to look like. And while we were all really grateful to have our soldiers home for the holidays, we were also sort of feeling this anxiety of, okay, if we have to do this, let's just do this. Let's just get this started. And so his leaving, in a weird way, can't come soon enough. But the other nice piece of that is you know, they'll all be home in July, and hopefully they'll all be home safe and sound. And 2010 has a whole other 6 months to be defined by something else, to be defined by other achievements, and not necessarily as this great strain.
That's Mary Galletti. Her husband, Russell, is a first lieutenant in the Ohio National Guard, and he deploys for Afghanistan soon as part of the 30,000 U.S. troop surge. Thanks so much to both of you, and good luck in the new year. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Iraq has expressed disappointment at the dismissal by a U.S. judge of all charges against five security guards from the Blackwater Company accused of killing 17 unarmed civilians in Baghdad back in 2007. The chairman of Iraq's Foreign Affairs Committee, Muwaffaq al-Rubai, told the BBC Iraqis were right to feel angry that the charges had been dropped.
They were civilian Iraqis. They were not military. They were not attacking. They were not terrorists. They were ordinary Iraqi citizens.
Iraqi officials are now calling for a retrial in the case.
In Afghanistan, we're learning more about how a suicide bomber infiltrated a U.S. base, killing seven CIA employees. Officials tell the AP the bomber was invited to the base and was not searched since he was being courted as an informant. And back at home, President Obama has summoned intelligence and homeland security chiefs to the White House for a meeting on Tuesday. They'll go over the security breakdowns leading up to the attempted bombing of a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, Domino's is half a century old. That's how long they've been getting pizza to people's houses in less than 30 minutes. And after 50 years of experience making pizza, they're changing their recipe. All the way down to the cheese. We're going to
talk about that. Terror strikes the colleges of America.
Terror or eager anticipation?
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. Our takeout segment today should maybe be called delivery segment because we're talking pizza. Domino's pizza, to be exact, that staple of late night eating. Those people that will bring you hot cheese when no one else will in under 30 minutes. They're changing their recipe. They're turning 50 in 2010, and they said they've been getting some complaints about the pizza. Just keep it moving. Keep it moving, Headley. Russell Wiener is Chief Marketing Officer for Domino's. Hi, Russell.
Hey, Luke. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little nervous because there are many nights in my life when the hour is late and the telephone calls to me that I need some Domino's. Where are you changing the pizza?
Well, I can tell you, don't be nervous. And if it wasn't so early in the morning, I'd love to be delivering one to you right now. But, you know, we've been around, as you said, for 50 years. And, you know, we listened to our consumers, and we certainly were proud of our former pizza. But our feeling was that if we could deliver something to the consumers that they liked better, and, I mean, our data says, I mean, we're talking 25% better than our prior pizza, then we should give it to them, and that's what we're doing.
Are you a little worried, though, because there's a troubled history with, like, New Coke and people doing things? I mean, you've been around for 50 years, so people are buying the pizza. I mean, are you worried changing it's going to alienate some folks?
Well, certainly going in, you make sure with everything you do that you don't end up in that situation. You know, the New Coke analogy, I'm not sure that one holds because, I mean, Coke was a brand that was known for taste, the classic taste of Coca-Cola. We're a brand that's known, certainly consumers, you know, like the taste of our pizza, but when you say the word Domino's, more delivery comes to mind. So the analogy for New Coke to me would be akin to us saying we don't deliver anymore. And that's, you know, we're the number one delivery pizza company in the world. So, you know, we're a delivery company that also wants to be known, you know, just as much and loved just as much for our pizza. And that's why we're doing this.
Well, what are you guys actually going to do to this new pizza?
What I like to say is the only thing that's the same with this and our old pizza is that they're both round.
Wow.
So we've changed the crust, we've changed the sauce, and we've changed the cheese. We've ended up with a pizza that just, you know, from the first bite to the last, and that's the piece I'm kind of personally most proud of, is, I mean, you could start biting this pizza in the front, or you could start with the crust, and you'll love it.
I feel like most people are pretty straightforward on how the pizza's eaten, though. Most people just go, you know, from the cheese back to the crust.
No, sometimes people fold it.
Yes, Lester. I think in this case, what we're going to do is our new crust is so delicious, people are going to start eating it backwards. Mark this day, mark this interview.
And we were.
I think people,
this is the beginning
people
of a
will
new
be
trend.
Looking back to this interview as the day that they start eating pizza.
Historic, historic things. Boy, we were worried that they were there just here to flog Domino's pizza. No, that's not the case. Russell Wiener here to expound on the virtues of their new pizza stuff. Chief Marketing Officer at Domino's. Thanks, Russell. Time for our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Last night, Navy rolled over Missouri 35-13 in the Texas Bowl. And as always, as New Year's comes along, it means major bowl games. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, let's jump right in. What bowl games are we looking forward to?
The game that I want to jump to first, of course, is the Gator Bowl. It may not be the biggest grossing, the most important game, but it features the last game for Coach Bobby Bowden.
The legend.
Correct. And Bobby Bowden started his career coaching at West Virginia, Florida State, where he currently coaches, where he became the legend,
yeah.
Well, one of his legendary times. The 80-year-old Bobby Bowden is going to play his last game against his first team, and it's going to be in Florida. This is going to be somewhat of a tearjerker for some.
I know. It's sad when you see these coaches, like, I thought this was going to be what happened to Joe Paterno. You coach forever, you have all these wins, and then you just have a really bad, like, last three or four seasons. Somehow Joe Pa turned it around. So unfortunately, Bowden didn't really get to do that. He's kind of going out on a sour note.
He is. And this brings us back to some of the other conversations about coaches this year, because what we have also is Oregon versus Ohio State. In the Rose Bowl. And I really like Oregon in this one. Mm-hmm. I think Ohio State doesn't play great at the end of the year. And Oregon has a lot to prove. They started off the season highly ranked, and everyone touted them to win a national championship. Moving on, in the Sugar Bowl, this is the game that I'm really excited about, where you have Cincinnati face Florida. And this is the SEC Florida, the powerhouse, with Tim Tebow as the quarterback. Now, going back to the coaching conversation, Urban Meyer, the coach of Florida.
Yeah, the retire, unretire, maybe.
Precisely. Because of his health issues, look for Florida to come out very emotional.
Yeah.
They're going to come out, you know, with like Bible verses like Tim Tebow right under their eye black and ready to go. Now, the other thing is Cincinnati, the coach Kelly has just left and now he's coaching for Notre Dame.
And exactly. Like he said he had to start recruiting. He couldn't even go coach the game, right?
Precisely. So
that's
now,
ridiculous.
So look for the seniors and the juniors for Cincinnati to also come out with a lot of energy to prove, I think, out of all the games, this is the game to watch.
Is there one more sleeper, like a game that you're looking at the roster and you think this could actually be interesting?
So that's the PapaJohns.com bowl. I know the name is funny. We're in this era of this, but
right.
South Carolina versus UConn, Connecticut. South Carolina is a really tough team. This is another SEC South Carolina.
Steve Spurrier's there now, right?
Correct. versus the Big East, which is UConn. This is another sort of stylistic difference. The SEC has a lot of big, fast, strong guys. They play a hard-nosed football game, and the Big East is a little bit more skill-oriented, speedy guys around the edges. And both of those games, the South Carolina-UConn and then Florida and Cincinnati, my bet is that they're going to both be high-scoring, high-flying, exciting football games.
And that's just how we like them here on The Takeaway. Thank you, Ibrahim, for being with us. You have a great weekend.
For our third and last takeout, it's time to hear from you, our listeners. All week, we've been asking you to share your New Year's resolutions with us, and here's one listener.
Hey, this is Seth from Hoboken. My New Year's resolution is to eat and live more locally.
Well, not to brag, Seth, but I am also working on my eating.
Giving up Arby's does not count as living more local.
Well, I thought it was a reasonable segue. I'm going to tell you more about this, Celeste, the lengths that I've gone to try to get myself in on this resolution of no fast food for 2010 that's coming up.
Listener John Hahn has a resolution not for himself, but for the U.S. government. He wrote to us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org, and John says, America needs to stop spending wildly and get every person a job. Without good work for our citizens, we cannot hope to be a great nation.
And no, we don't have time for it, do we?
No.
I was going to play this thing from Troy. We'll have to do that later because he's a fan of yours, Celeste.
Is he?
A big fan.
Troy's
yeah.
a nice guy from North Dakota. We're all always listening at The Takeaway. Let us know what you have to say at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. With me, Luke Burbank, for at least another hour and a half or so. He's filling in for John Hockenberry. John will be back on Monday. Coming up, a BBC News host takes us to Yemen for a really close look at the Yemeni people and what they're thinking while their country has come into the international spotlight because of Al-Qaeda. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A federal judge has thrown out the indictment of five former Blackwater security guards over a shooting in Baghdad 2 years ago that left 17 Iraqis dead. The security guards were accused of firing into a crowd of civilians, but the judge found the government improperly used evidence to build its case. The chairman of Iraq's Foreign Affairs Committee, Mowafaq al-Rubai, says the former security guards should be sent to Iraq.
We will ask the U.S. government to return these Blackwater employees to Baghdad to stand trial in Baghdad.
In the past hour, General Ray Odierno, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, says there's some concern that the ruling might provoke revenge attacks on other security firms working in Iraq. President Obama will meet with his intelligence and homeland security chiefs on Tuesday to discuss how to prevent a repeat of the attempted bombing of a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day.
The new year bringing some new laws with it. Starting today, same-sex marriages are legal in New Hampshire. Restaurants in California will not be allowed to cook with trans fat. And in North Carolina, which, of course, is the nation's leading grower of tobacco, it will finally be illegal to smoke in restaurants and bars. Also, AT&T says it will no longer sponsor Tiger Woods, joining Accenture, Tag Heuer, and Gillette in dropping support for the golfer after those numerous allegations of infidelity. And this is the other side of that story, maybe happier. Call it the silver lining of the recession. New numbers show American divorce rate dropping to its lowest point in 30 years. Brad Wilcox, the director of the National Marriage Project, says some people are postponing divorce because their home values have dropped.
That's a terrible reason
whatever
to
it
not
takes,
get divorced.
Whatever it takes. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
We've been discussing the attempt by a young Nigerian man to blow up a Detroit-bound Northwest flight on Christmas Day. Al-Qaeda affiliates in Yemen reportedly sent that man on that mission. They're claiming responsibility anyway. Owen Bennett Jones just returned from Yemen. He's the host of the BBC News Hour program, and he joined us earlier this morning from England to talk about how the Yemeni people feel about their country being so in the news recently. He spoke to two people in Yemen with very different views on it. First, a newspaper editor.
In my opinion, Al-Qaeda is somebody else's problem. It's not ours.
But you also met a Yemeni rapper named AJ who writes songs with an anti-Al-Qaeda message.
Yes, man, in Yemen, al-Watan, my home. Al-Qaeda, not welcome, so let it be known. Al-Habi, ain't wanna know no terrorists, please.
So, Owen, is this a fairly accurate picture? Is there a divide in Yemen?
Well, I should say the rapper was really a Yemeni-American, so perhaps that explains his perspective. Now, I think there is a fairly universal feeling in Yemen that the Al-Qaeda threat is not really their problem. They have a lot of problems of their own to worry about. They have a civil war in the north of the country, and they have a very substantial independence movement in the south of the country. So the government feels really under siege. And the al-Qaeda problem is there, but it is the least of their problems.
Well, this is also a pretty poor country. We often think of Middle East countries as being rich because of oil, but Yemen has serious problems with poverty.
Sure, the oil is running out. The revenues are down 75% this year. That's partly because of price falls, but also because of declining production. And to throw into the mix, if that all weren't enough, there is a shortening supply of water. You know, the population has grown so much as a result of the oil money over the last 20, 30 years that it has created a situation where the water table is falling by something terrifying like 8 meters a year. So, I mean, Yemen has very, very serious problems. And as I say, al-Qaeda is one of them, but it's by no means the biggest.
Well, you know, can you maybe even paint a picture for us on how much al-Qaeda is in the daily minds of Yemenis? I mean, we had the foreign minister last week saying that they think they have maybe 200 or 300 al-Qaeda militants in the country. But this is a country with 26 million people, so that's a relatively small population.
No, sure. I mean, nobody knows. I don't know if the foreign minister really knows how many there are, but he's just trying to, you know, downplay it, I guess. And, you know, there clearly is an issue. They've got al-Qaeda operating in the rural areas. There are attacks, generally very low-level attacks. So the sort of thing that will go on is that a provincial security official in some provincial town will be killed, and al-Qaeda will claim it. But no major attacks in the center of Sada for a year or so. The last one was on the American embassy, so not really a domestic target. And so, you know, it's a low-level rumbling problem. And the government obviously want to make enough of it to get any American resources that might be available to help them combat it, but at the same time not to exaggerate it to the extent that the Americans get so concerned they start really interfering in Yemeni politics.
Well, it's funny you should mention this, because this is a clip of the Yemen's foreign minister speaking earlier this week to a BBC reporter.
Well, I'm sure that the United States can do a lot, Britain can do a lot, the European Union can do a lot in that regard. There is actually, at the moment, some support that is coming. I must say it's inadequate.
It sounds like he's asking Western nations and UN members to come in and help, but you say that you don't want them, they don't want those countries meddling too much. So what kind of support are they looking for? Just financial?
Well, sure. I mean, no doubt they're looking for what Pakistan's been looking for and what others look for, which is financial assistance to beef up their army. You know, they've got a civil war going on in the north. They've got this secessionist movement in the south. So they've got lots of military needs. As they see it, those would be the priorities. And no doubt they're hoping that they can raise some serious assistance from the United States, which would help them in those conflicts. So, you know, it's a familiar picture. The Americans face a difficult dilemma. And, you know, and on top of all of this, you have to remember that nearly half the people left in Guantanamo are Yemenis. And, of course, after all this, with this Detroit thing, there's ever lessening chance that the American administration will feel able to return those people to Yemen. And yet, in Yemen, there is, you know, really quite strong anti-Americanism, partly founded on the basis that most people think those Yemenis are entirely innocent and shouldn't be in Guantanamo. So, I mean, that's another sort of element which is affecting the popular mood in Yemen.
Do they acknowledge those who were released from Guantanamo and then went on to be involved in terrorist acts?
Sure. I mean, most of those are Saudis, actually. So, I mean, there are quite a few. I mean, there are not many Yemenis have been let out. Those who have been let out, I met quite a few of them, are living peacefully in Yemen, and they're quite closely monitored. I'm not aware of any Yemenis who have gone back to struggle. There may well be, you know, one or two, but certainly there are Saudis who've done that and who are based in Yemen. So that sort of confuses
the picture. Oh, I see.
They're
based in Yemen, but they're not Yemenis.
So, I mean, yes. I mean, you know, we have American congressmen openly describing these Yemenis in Guantanamo as terrorists. And yet, you know, in Yemen, that is simply not how it's perceived. They say if they're terrorists, then charge them and put them in jail, certainly. But if not, then release them and send them back home.
Well, it seems clear at this point that the United States is going to have to be involved in Yemen to some extent, whether that be as small as sending a check or whether as large as actually possibly sending troops over. But is the Yemeni government a stable partner? Are we possibly entering into another partnership in anti-terrorist activities where their partner is not secure?
Well, it's weak. You know, I mean, they do face, as I've mentioned, these very serious challenges. And it is a tribal society, so, you know, many, many Yemenis of the 22 million, many of them basically have greater loyalty to their tribe than to the central government. So, you know, the government has always managed by mediating the various forces that exist in Yemeni society rather than by imposing itself. There is quite a strong army. I mean, they are fighting seriously in the north, and they're trying to quell this rebellion up there. But, you know, they haven't managed to do so in 5 years. So that gives you some impression of just how much authority the Yemeni government has. And the United States does face, you know, a serious, you know, a classic foreign policy dilemma. And whether they pour money into a government that really isn't in a position to deliver the results the Americans want is the challenge that you know, the administration faces.
And that was Owen Bennett-Jones, host of BBC's NewsHour, speaking to us earlier this morning. Coming up, in movies, is it a return to the past? You know, Hollywood always has a tough time letting go of the past, but this time they can't seem to let go of the 80s. We're going to take a look at what films are opening in 2010 and ask whether or not anyone's writing any original screenplays.
They're not making Mannequin 2 again, are they? Because that was a masterpiece.
This is a Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Celeste, do I look different today? Have you noticed anything?
You have a sweater on.
I'm in day one of my 2010 New Year's resolution to lay off the fast food.
Luca Burbank in 2010, yes. No fast food, right?
That's right. None. That was the plan. But I've made that promise before, and I haven't been able to stick with it. So I was getting serious this year. Yesterday, we brought a hypnotist here to the studios of WNYC, a guy named Jeffrey Rose. He's the founder of this place called the Advanced Hypnosis Center. And he gave me this explanation about how hypnotism might actually help me hang on to my no fast food resolution.
Habits are basically subconscious patterns. So you don't want to address them with willpower or on a conscious level. Because consciously people know that the habit they're doing that's bad, they should stop. But they've been doing it for a long time. It's habitual. In hypnosis, I'm able to address the subconscious and program the subconscious with all the motivation, inspiration, and reasons that person wants to make that change. And it gets them to associate more pain with continuing to use what they're, you know, what they're using or eating or doing or drinking, and more pleasure being free of it.
So his thing, he says, is that it's about negative association, making it so that the thing you don't want to do makes you actually feel sick or
right.
Really, you just really dislike it. So he puts me into this trance state, right? This is with cameras rolling. You can see all this, by the way, at the Takeaway website if you want to see video of this. He starts counting me down, tells me I'm on a desert island, and I start
and
to
you
go.
You allow yourself to drift deeper now into trance as I count from 10 down to 1. With every number I count, you'll find yourself drifting and floating a little deeper and deeper. So by the time I reach the number 1, you'll be at your deepest level and always awake.
So it actually kind of worked. I started to feel, I didn't know if it was sleepy or trancy, but I felt something. I was imagining myself on the island, and then this is when he got to the important stuff, where he basically instructed my subconscious that fast food was going to make me feel really nauseous.
You have a very strong willpower and a tremendous amount of self-control. No desire for any fast foods. No desire for French fries or processed foods. If you eat any kind of junk food, any kind of fast food, you will feel very sick and very nauseous.
So that's in my subconscious now.
I want you, we're going to test this out real
this
quick.
This is, you know, I have to say,
we brought
kind
in
of a little
one
bit
of your
a low
favorites.
Blow. McDonald's
hash
browns.
I can see the grease glistening.
I honestly can eat 4 or 5 of these in a sitting under usual
circumstances. Well, you ready to take a bite?
I'm taking a sniff. I have to say, not nearly as appealing as they have been in the past.
Do you feel like throwing up?
I don't feel sick. So I don't know if only half of the hypnotism took. But
well, he said if you eat any junk food.
I don't feel as drawn to this as I would. I'm actually not even kidding you. I have last night when I was walking around town, I was getting a little bit hungry and I was trying to think, what can I eat? And the furthest thing from my mind was unhealthy food.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And then I went to the place and I ordered a Cuban sandwich at this place called Puck Fair. And it comes with fries. And I said, no, thank you. I will have the salad. True
wow.
story. So it might
maybe
be working.
Maybe there's something to it.
If you want to see a video of this, a very embarrassing video of me being put in some kind of trance state, it's all up at the Takeaways website.
That's how you feel today, the day after the hypnosis. But we'll have to check in with you at like 3 months and 6 months and see how much you've invested in Arby's by then.
I have a CD of affirmations from this guy that I'm supposed to listen to every day to like recharge the hypnosis.
Right.
So it's pretty exciting. Big thanks, by the way, to Jeffrey Rose. He's the founder of the Advanced Hypnosis Center.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee, sitting here with Luke Burbank for at least another hour or so more. He's filling in for John Hockenberry, and John will be back on Monday. It is 2010 already, and in 2010, if you're going to the movies, it may look like it's a much earlier year, because we're going to see nothing but remakes and sequels this year. And in that vein, we have some Friday trivia for you. Robin Hood, easily one of the most recognizable and familiar characters used often in films. So we're asking you, who was the original Robin Hood in talking films? Now, not in silent pictures, but as soon as talking pictures came around, who was the original Robin Hood? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. See if you can beat our film critic, Rafer Guzman, with the answer. First, here's a check on the leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. The authorities in Nigeria say the man accused of trying to blow up an American airliner on Christmas Day, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, began his journey in Ghana. It originally been assumed he'd started his string of airline trips in his home country of Nigeria. Meanwhile, a close friend of the suspect, Kasim Rafiq, says the man showed no signs of violent extremism when the two studied together in the UK.
It actually hurts me that this individual did what he did. If I could speak to him now, I would ask him, you know, what is it that drove you down this road?
President Obama will meet with his intelligence and homeland security chiefs on Tuesday to discuss how to prevent a repeat of the attempted bombing attack, the brazen attack that killed 7 CIA employees at a remote outpost in Afghanistan on Wednesday, is raising questions about how the CIA operates. Earlier, we spoke to retired CIA officer Michael Scheuer. He said indications are that the attacker was a member of the Afghan army, and this is the latest sign the army has been infiltrated.
If he was in the military, it simply suggests that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have followed through on what they promised to do, and that is to put people into the military and have them enlist and receive the training.
Japan's experienced the biggest recorded fall in its population since the Second World War. Government estimates say the number of deaths in 2009 exceeded the number of births by 75,000. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
You know, as we say goodbye to the first decade of this century and move on into the new one, I'm left with the question, is there anyone writing original screenplays anymore?
It would not appear so.
Well, Hollywood never has an easy time letting go of the past, but next year is a little bit ridiculous. Some major hit films from the 1980s are coming back. Wall Street, Karate Kid, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Many classics are being remade and sequels coming out in 2010. Rafer Guzman, film critic from Newsday and Takeaway contributor, we're returning to the 1980s?
Yeah, I think there might be a couple things going on with that. One is, doesn't it always seem like 20 years is kind of the magic number for a revival, whether it's a fashion trend or a movie remake? You know, you've got a new generation that doesn't remember it, so they think it's fresh and new. And then you've got people of a certain age, like myself, who, you know, might feel nostalgic for that era. So I think the 80s are kind of hitting, a sweet spot there.
I'm also of a certain age. I just turned 40, as we and many people know, and I'm not nostalgic for the 80s. But let's go through these movies. We've got, obviously, this one, timely, Wall Street. That was the film originally came out in 1987. It was Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas. Here's a clip from that movie.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
So clearly this is a theme that resonates today as easily as it did in the 1980s.
Yes, indeed. And Oliver Stone is returning to make the sequel. It's Wall Street 2. Shia LaBeouf takes over the Charlie Sheen role as the newbie in this one, but Michael Douglas is back as Gordon Gekko. He's out of prison and he's back trying to establish himself as a player on Wall Street. I think what's interesting about the first movie is that Gordon Gekko became like a really popular anti-hero. He was almost like Pacino's Scarface.
Right.
You know, people really lionized this guy. And that movie actually became inadvertently kind of a recruiting tool for Wall Street. People, Wall Streeters will often say that movie, made them want to, get in the ring. And this could be a very different movie. Oliver Stone's been shooting this movie just over this past year. in light of the financial crisis. So I think it might be a lot more topical and perhaps more pointed than the first one even.
Okay, so let's talk about one that's not necessarily quite as news-related, and that's the remake of the 1982 sci-fi thriller Tron, which many people may remember.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
I totally forgot Jeff Bridges is in that movie.
Everyone did, yeah.
Jeff Bridges, and that's, of course, at a time when computers, not everybody had a computer in their home.
Right.
So it's kind of a different feeling for Tron this time.
Right. And you know, this actually is also not a remake. This is a sequel. This is called Tron Legacy, which I think is kind of an interesting choice because doesn't legacy usually mean old technology?
Right.
So that's kind of a funny, you know, idea. I think, you know, the original was so interesting in terms of its special effects. Do you remember the light cycles that rode on the grid and turned at right angles? Well, right angles they seemed so high tech at the time, right?
If it was on a grid. My dream as a kid was to become a millionaire and get a light cycle.
Right, exactly.
That was 8-year-old Luke Burbank's life dream.
Right. This one, from what I've seen and just stills, it looks very similar. That could be a problem. I was noticing that it comes out December 17th, which is almost a year to the day after the release of Avatar. And, right angles just don't look so high-tech anymore.
Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, it's a Disney film. Disney's generally smart. You know, they generally know what they're doing. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. And Jeff Bridges
Disney,
is back.
Generally smart. I have two words for you. Black Cauldron.
Well, okay.
There's also going to be a number of sequels. This is what I'm really, really looking forward to, the sequel to Iron Man, which was surprising to me. And how much I enjoyed that movie came out in 2008. And how good is this one to be? Let's go listen to the trailer.
Can we pick up now where we left off? Mr. Stark, please.
Yes, dear.
Can I have your attention?
Absolutely.
Our priority here is to have you turn over the Iron Man weapon to the American people.
Well, you can forget it. We're safe. America is secure. You want my property? You can't have it. But I did you a big favor. I have successfully privatized world peace.
What do you think about this movie?
The first one was such a surprise hit. I think it's interesting that you said how surprised you were. I think a lot of people felt that way, that a superhero movie could be something kind of smart and kind of sexy and kind of intelligent. I think a lot of that is down to Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, it was nuanced.
Exactly.
And I'm not used to saying that about a comic book movie.
Exactly. Not much has been released in terms of the plot for this one, but as you might remember, you know, the first one left itself wide open for a sequel.
Absolutely.
And so I think this will probably be...
Plus, remember, Tony Stark appears at the end of the Hulk movie, too.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
You kind of wonder what kind of little threads I'm
you're more
showing.
Of a, you're more of a superhero fan than you're letting on.
I'm a comic book person,
yet okay.
Just more of my dorkiness. But here's one where this is a sequel which is coming out, and I bet we could all come up with a plot that was pretty close to what it's going to be.
It's been 2 years, and in 2 years, amazing things can happen. Things you thought would never happen in a million years. And just when you think you've seen it all, it hits you. You haven't seen anything yet.
How many variations of the boy meets girl, boy and girl sleep together and break up for a quirky reason can we get?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the answer may be infinite. I mean,
yes.
Sex
and the City sequel
right.
coming out.
Sex and the City 2, same cast. The men are back. Chris Noth is back. David Eigenberg is back. I think it's interesting that clip essentially tells you nothing about what's going to happen in that
Zero.
Film. Absolutely nothing. So, you know, as if that's
maybe,
even important.
Actually, maybe that is what happens in that film. But
perhaps.
We need to move on because we have Friday trivia. Robin Hood, clearly. I mean, I actually looked up the number of times Robin Hood's been used in films, and it's ridiculous how many times he's appeared. So we're asking today, who is the original Robin Hood? In Talking Pictures, who was the very first Robin Hood? Rafer Guzman?
I'm going to take the obvious guess. Is it Errol Flynn?
It is Errol Flynn.
Now this forest is wide. It can shelter and clothe and feed a band of good determined men, good swordsmen, good archers, good fighters. Are you with me?
I'm with you, Errol Flynn. That's in the movie Robin Hood in 1938. Some people answered Douglas Fairbanks, but Douglas was actually in the silent film that came before the one we just played. Actually, Rafer was beat by one of our listeners.
Jason Harms. I'm from Tom's River, and I do believe it was Errol Flynn. Yeah.
I'll give that a shot.
Nice work, Jason Harms. As we mentioned, the remake of Robin Hood, along with so many other retakes, is coming out in 2010. Thanks so much, Rafer Guzman, film critic at Newsday and Takeaway contributor.
We just need to get the Kevin Costner taste out of our mouth.
Why did you have to bring Kevin Costner into the conversation?
We're taking your thoughts on how you're going to keep your New Year's resolutions now that you've made them. Hypnotism is just one way you could do that. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley. Thanks for hanging out with me, Luke Burbank.
I'm Luke Burbank. This is The Takeaway. A new year and new challenges in Afghanistan, including possible trust issues between U.S. forces and the Afghans they're training. We now know that the suicide bomber who killed 8 Americans on Wednesday at a remote military base was wearing an Afghan National Army uniform. The U.S. is trying to win the hearts and minds of not only Afghan civilians, but the country's military. The question is, has the Taliban already beaten them to the punch? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, world. It's New Year's Day.
It is.
I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry for just a few more moments here with Celeste Headley.
Happy New Year, not John till Monday. Happy New Year, Luke.
Yes.
Let's get right to the top stories this morning since I can't make casual conversation. A federal judge has thrown out the indictment of 5 former Blackwater security guards over a shooting in Baghdad 2 years ago that left 17 Iraqis dead. The guards were accused of firing into a crowd of civilians, but the judge found that the government improperly used evidence to build its case. General Ray Odierno, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, says it's important to understand that both the U.S. and Iraq had to follow the rule of law.
Of course, people are not going to like it because they believe that these individuals conducted some violence and should be punished for it. But the bottom line is, using the rule of law, the evidence obviously is not there, or was collected illegally or whatever the reason is, and so it can't be used.
This morning in Pakistan, a suicide bomber drove a car onto a field during a volleyball tournament and detonated, killing at least 20 people. While across the border in Afghanistan, we're learning more about how a suicide bomber infiltrated a U.S. base, killing 7 CIA employees. Officials tell the AP the bomber was invited to the base and wasn't searched because he was being courted as an informant.
For the latest, we're joined by Anand Gopal, the Wall Street Journal reporter in Kabul. Anand, do we know anything else about the identity of this suicide bomber?
We do. We know that he had worn an Afghan army uniform and that he was invited onto the base. There's some talk that he may have been used, or possibly or thought to be used as a informant for the CIA in their operations. And so for that reason, they brought him onto the base, perhaps to brief him or to get more information from him.
So they don't know if he was actually a member of the Afghan National Army. They just know he had a uniform on, right?
That's right. There's been a number of other incidents where insurgents have worn army and police uniforms to carry out attacks. And the Afghan army itself has denied that this person had any connection to the army.
All right, Anand, stay with us. We're going to get back to you in just a moment. Back at home, President Obama will meet with his intelligence and homeland security chiefs on Tuesday to discuss how to prevent a repeat of that attempted bombing of a U.S. airliner that happened on Christmas Day. Meanwhile, a former friend of the attempted bomber tells our partner, the BBC, Omar Farouk Abdul Muttalib never showed any signs of violent extremism while living in England.
When I heard the news, I wasn't sure what to think. You know, I thought, could this really be the same person? The humble, the kind, the well-mannered, well-spoken individual that I knew and I was a close friend to went on to do what he did.
Abdul Muttalib is being held at a federal prison in Michigan.
Later in the hour, we're going to wrap up our Decade in Review series with a look at the most interesting and unforgettable pop culture phenomenon of the 2000s. That's one of the ways in which we've been kind of looking back on the decade behind us. Another way is by asking you what your New Year's resolutions are, maybe new decade resolutions. And now
that's
a
lot of pressure.
Yeah,
like a 10-year resolution.
Oh, really?
I think so. I think maybe we start with 1 year.
That gives you 10 years to get it done.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I'm more thinking of withholding things from myself for 10 years. You're talking about just like giving yourself a longer time.
Right, because mine is to become debt-free, you know.
Smart. Very smart.
Okay, so we're asking for your suggestions on how to actually hold true to your resolutions. How do you stick to it? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And then coming up on Wednesday, a suicide bomber in Afghanistan dressed in the uniform of an Afghan military person killed 7 CIA officers. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to a former CIA officer and find out about the efficacy of our war strategy over there in that region. This is The Takeaway. Good morning. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. He will be back on Monday. We've got developments in that story concerning the attack of a suicide bomber who killed 7 CIA employees in Afghanistan on Wednesday. The Taliban has now claimed responsibility. One of the questions, though, is whether the Taliban has actually infiltrated the Afghan army. Let's go back to Anand Gopal, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's based in Kabul. We'll get an update from him right now. Anand, can you tell us more about what goes on at this base? It's in Host, and it's a CIA base, but it's otherwise pretty mysterious. What actually happens there?
Well, it's a CIA base, but it's also a U.S. military base, and so the military uses this to conduct operations in the area. The base is very close to the Pakistani border, and that's one of the reasons it's important. And the CIA there uses it as sort of hub to collect information and intelligence, which they then pass on to the U.S. military to carry out raids and operations.
Now, this bomber was wearing an Afghan military uniform. Would it be surprising for a member of the Afghan military to be walking around on this base? Is that sort of a common thing over there, or would that be something that should stick out?
No, it's pretty common. Most of the military bases here, Afghan army and Afghan police are in those bases. A lot of times, U.S. units are training Afghan soldiers, so it's not a common sight, and probably one of the reasons he's able to get in unexpected.
Is the CIA's presence at this base in Host, is that supposed to be a big secret?
It's supposed to be a secret. The CIA's presence everywhere in the country is supposed to be a secret, but in base, like many others, you have Afghan soldiers, police, private contractors, Afghan laborers. So in some ways, it needs to keep that secret.
Let's bring Michael Scheuer into the conversation. He's former head of the CIA's Bin Laden tracking unit. He retired from the CIA in 2004. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Would you say this definitely typifies a sort of breach in security on this military base?
Not if he was a Afghan Army officer, no. If he was in the Afghan Army, as your reporter said, it's pretty common to have the U.S. military, the Afghan military, and the CIA on the same bases. If he was in the military, it simply suggests that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have followed through on what they promised to do, and that is to put people into the military and have them enlist and receive the training.
You know, one of the things the president said when he announced this surge of troops for Afghanistan was that the U.S. Troops were going to be able to train Afghans. Is this something that puts a major kind of hitch in that plan, you know, ideologically at least, between the U.S. and these people who they're hoping to train but who may be acting out attacks on them?
The whole plan to train a national Afghan army that can exert control over the whole country is something that's pretty foreign to Afghan culture. It's very much a nation of not only regions but provinces and even valleys. And usually the building of strong central institutions in Afghanistan ends up causing war rather than stopping war. So the plan to train this army is it probably looks good on paper, but historically and culturally it's a very long shot indeed.
What do you think the response in Afghanistan from the Afghans to the surge is? Are they relieved to maybe have more roads built and have more security, or do they see it as a continued imposition?
My own view on that is that they'll accept whatever we build in terms of physical infrastructure. They'd be happy to have it. Once we're gone, they'll probably protect it. But increasingly,
we're viewed as occupiers, and so 30,000 new troops are not enough to win or to prevail, but it's enough to make us look, not only in Afghanistan, but across the Muslim world, as a even greater occupying power. So I'm afraid there's a, in a year from now, we're going to be talking about another big rethink about what we're doing in Afghanistan.
Michael Scheuer, I'm just wondering, the Taliban has claimed responsibility for this attack. And I'm wondering, how reliable are those kind of claims? Are we sure that every time the Taliban claims responsibility that they did it?
Certainly not. They make claims all the time about things, as do we, that turn out not to be true. But this is a pretty important one. Generally speaking, the Taliban and al-Qaeda have a pretty good track record when they claim things that are big news stories and that they did. They're also very good at announcing when they don't do things. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to take, at least for the moment, until it's proved otherwise, at face value the claim. And also, our enemy is probably at its strongest in eastern Afghanistan, immediately around the base at Host.
It is nuts.
Michael Scheuer, former head of the CIA's Bin Laden Tracking Unit. Thanks so much for joining us. Also, a big thanks to Anand Gopal, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He was in Kabul.
We have more details on the situation in Iran. Iran had a December 31st deadline to agree to the deal to ship out most of its uranium. That's a UN deadline that was set in October. And in return, Iran was going to get fuel from a medical reactor. Clearly, the deadline has now passed. Joining us now is Kajra Naji. He's a special correspondent for BBC Persian Television. Kajra, did Iran take any moves to meet the deadline?
Absolutely not. The deadline was by and large a non-event in Iran. Iranian leaders are up to their neck in trouble, facing a very strong opposition on the streets of Tehran and other big cities. Any concession on any foreign policy issue would have been fatal for a weakened regime. So I don't think Iranian leaders are going to tear their hair out now that they've missed the deadline.
Well, you're just talking about the ongoing street protests that have been going on almost since this summer's elections. But I'm wondering, the UN and President Obama have threatened some very tough sanctions. Is that something the Iranian government is concerned about?
Well, I think they would be concerned about, because, you know, it will pile on more pressure on Iran at the time that they are facing this trouble at home. And it's not a prospect that any government would cherish. But nevertheless, as I said, the internal dynamics are more important these days.
Well, speaking of those internal dynamics, Iran's opposition leader, Mir Hossein Mousavi, announced this morning that he's ready to die. And that seems like it comes out of nowhere from this side of the ocean. What does that mean?
No, I mean, inside Iran, there were speculations that Mir Hossein Mousavi and the other leader of the opposition were about to get arrested. And on the streets of Tehran in the last few days, there have been very important speakers, senior clergymen, who've been calling for their execution, in fact, if they don't repent. So things were pretty tense. So this statement says basically that, don't worry, I'm not going to worry about getting arrested or executed. And he says arresting me or executing me or other leaders of the opposition is not going to resolve the problems.
Okay, thanks so much. That's Kajra Naji. He's a special correspondent for BBC Persian Television. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
The head of the U.S. military's Central Command, General David Petraeus, has said there are significant signs of progress in Iraq. Speaking in Baghdad this morning, he said progress has continued in 2009, rather, despite the drawing down of U.S. troops to around 110,000. He said he was confident progress would continue this year.
Countries, businesses don't put their money in some place unless they think that there is real potential. And what you have seen in Iraq in recent months in particular has been considerable outside investment.
The number of civilians killed in Iraq in 2009 dropped by around half on the previous year, according to reports from human rights groups.
Staying with Iraq, senior officials in that country say they're very disappointed that a judge in the U.S. has thrown out a high-profile case against five security contractors. The five were working for Blackwater in 2005 when they allegedly opened fire in Baghdad, killing 17 unarmed civilians. A U.S. judge dismissed the case, saying the evidence was not acceptable. Iraqi officials are calling for a retrial in Baghdad. That's some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, film critic Rafer Guzman drops by. He's got some predictions for the Golden Globes and a few surprise nominations.
Hey, you want that to go?
All right, we've got some takeouts for you. The first one concerning sports, which means we've got Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here. This is a big NFL weekend. The NFC playoff picture is pretty much locked up. But the AFC, there's still a lot of scrapping going on, trying to figure out who's going to get into the playoffs. Ibrahim, what's going on exactly in the AFC?
This is an interesting thing. When you're looking at the last game of the season, if you remember 2007, the New England Patriots were undefeated. Mm-hmm. They played the New York Giants in the last game of the season. That gives you a sense. The Giants decided not to rest their starters that year. They played a tough game against the Patriots, and it was a precursor to the Super Bowl. So what we're looking at with the last game of the season this year is who's going to rest their starters and what are some potential matchups going forward into the playoffs that we could look forward to. Now, in the AFC, the New York Jets are going to play the Cincinnati Bengals. Now there, the Bengals are probably going to rest their starters, and the Jets, if they win, they can clinch a playoff spot. Mark Sanchez, the quarterback for the Jets, has thrown 20 interceptions. Now, this week, he might have a tough time with the Cincinnati secondary, which is tough. So we'll see. If they are able to make this amazing climb back, then it could be amazing. Another side story in that is that Larry Johnson, who was the malign running back for Kansas City, mm-hmm. will probably get some playing time with Cincinnati. So we'll see where he's at.
Just don't let him near his Twitter account.
It's true. And Cincinnati's Chad Ochocinco has promised victory. So that should be interesting. Another couple games, Pittsburgh versus Miami. Their team's on playoff life support. They both need a win to help get into the playoffs, and they both need all the other teams to lose.
Wow.
So if you're a Pittsburgh fan or a Miami fan, you're hoping for a win, and you're hoping for everybody else in the world to lose.
I tell you, I have lots of friends who are Pittsburgh fans, and they have one season where they're not winning the Super Bowl, and they act like the sky is falling.
It's true.
Try being a Seahawks fan.
Well, that's a good point.
Okay, well, what else is happening?
Well, in the NFC, I love the NFC games. You have Green Bay versus Arizona. You have Philadelphia versus Dallas. In the Green Bay game, that's another playoff warm-up game. So Arizona could improve its seeding, and quarterback Aaron Rodgers has been sacked the most in the league. So this should be a good game just to watch. The other one is Philadelphia versus Dallas. That's the game of the weekend because that's for the NFC East title game. The winner of that wins that, and then the person to watch in that one is the Eagles' DeSean Jackson.
Yeah, that guy's crazy. He had like a kickoff return touchdown and like a nuts catch last week.
He's been a terror for defenses all year long. He's fast, he's speedy, he's quick, and he just has great hands. Watch for DeSean Jackson. The Eagles should get a victory.
All right, and you're going to get a big victory this weekend, right? As I hear. Can we say this? Am I busting you out?
We could say it.
Mazel tov. Getting married this weekend.
It's true. Saturday, I am getting married.
Congratulations to Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Thanks, man. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Our next takeout is about awards season. It's true. The year has wrapped up. That means that all the filmmakers are looking to see how many trophies they can collect. And we've got Golden Globe predictions from Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and Takeaway contributor. Okay, so Rafer, let's start with the biggie. What kind of films are up for the top award, Best Picture, in the Golden Globes?
Yeah, if you're looking at Best Picture, and you know, keep in mind that the Golden Globes split it into dramas and comedies.
Oh, that's right.
Now, but the drama category is basically the one that everyone looks at because that's kind of the predictor for the Oscars. And the dramas are Avatar, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, and Up in the Air.
Now, Avatar was almost an animated film.
Yes, I know. I often wondered if that should be counted as a live-action film or not.
Yeah,
But I think there are some rules. Well, I know in the Oscars there are some rules about what percentage of the film has to be animated for it to qualify for that category. Anyway, it's up here for Best Picture, but I think the real favorite right now seems to be Up in the Air.
The George Clooney picture.
Yeah, the George Clooney movie. There's a lot of critical support for The Hurt Locker. My theory is that what's going to happen is Up in the Air will get Best Picture, and they will split that
and give Best Director to Catherine Bigelow for The
female.
Hurt Locker. That's, yeah, a female. And if that happened at the Oscars, she would be the first female ever to win that award.
Wow. So what surprising nominations are there out there?
I think Sandra Bullock is the most surprising nomination.
That is a surprise.
And I think people are saying that she has a shot at getting nominated for Best Leading Actress in the Oscars. She's here. She's
really?
Up for it. Yes. She's up for it in the Globes.
Right.
That's for the blind side.
It's for the blind side, right?
That was
based on a true story.
Yeah, based on a true story. That was a surprise hit. I mean, that opened really strong. And even though I didn't think the movie was that great and it got kind of mixed reviews, people generally seem to think that Sandra Bullock was really good in that part. So, you know, she's up there with could be up there for the Oscars.
I
with the
like
heavy
Sandra
hitters.
Bullock.
I do too. Despite her spotty track record.
She does not get nominations, but somebody who pretty much always gets a nomination no matter what she's doing is Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep,
and
right.
She's competing against herself.
And she's competing against herself. That's right. She is up for Julie and Julia.
Right.
And also for, I'm going to forget.
It's complicated. Yeah.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what happens here. And it'll be interesting to see if Meryl Streep gets nominated for that at the Oscars, for a Best Actress for Julie and Julia at the Oscars. Because the Oscars tend not to nominate comedic roles that much in that
right.
in that category. But it was such an incredible job that she did in that movie that
she
you
really
know,
did
she's got a shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see how accurate you are, Rafer, as we go head toward the Golden Globes. Rafer Guzman, film critic at Newsday.
All right. Time for our last takeout where we turn the mic over to you, our loyal listeners. We've got more responses on that coverage that we've been bringing you over this attempted bombing of the airplane heading to Detroit, Michigan. Leah wrote to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Her email says, with all the talk going on about failure in our security system, nobody has mentioned the people who clean and service aircraft. They may be a vulnerable population. How can we be sure they are not able to sneak substances or weapons onto the planes and hide them for terrorists to retrieve after the plane is airborne? Think about it. Maintenance people need to use liquids and powders to clean and maintain planes. The food and drinks offered up are also liquid, no?
Well, you know, we're always interested in everything that our listeners have to say. There's actually a lively discussion going on the website about whether or not we should use the term rabbit ears as opposed to antenna. But the way to weigh in is to give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley, and for at least the next half hour, I have Luke Burbank with me, filling in for John Hockenberry.
Yes. Hello, Celeste.
Hello. Happy New Year. John will be back on Monday. Coming up, we end our week-long series on the U.S. Census with a look at why it matters whether or not we fill in the bubbles on that incredibly large head count. That's coming up in a moment, but first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama will meet his intelligence and homeland security chiefs on Tuesday to discuss how to prevent a repeat of the attempted bombing of a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day. In Afghanistan, another U.S. airstrike is being blamed for civilian deaths. This time, Afghan officials say 7 civilians were killed after an international patrol came under fire and called for air support.
Hundreds of new laws go into effect across the country today. Same-sex marriage now legal in New Hampshire, and restaurants in California will not be allowed to cook with trans fat. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
All week long, we've been talking about the 2010 census, and we wanted to leave you with some big picture perspective on the conversations we've had so far. Today, we have Nate Persily, professor of law and politics at Columbia University, and he's here in our studio. And on the phone with us is Ken Pruitt, the director of the 2000 census. So, Nate and Ken, here's a taste of what politicians and commentators are saying earlier this year, about half a year before. This is Glenn Beck and Representative Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota.
So let me talk about the census, because there's a lot of people that are concerned with it.
I think there is a point when you say enough is enough to government intrusion.
They're not comfortable with ACORN members coming to find out all this information. They don't want to give the government all this kind of information.
Does the federal government really need to know our phone numbers? Do they really need to know, like you said, the date and time that we leave, mental stability? You know the one question that's not on this survey, Glenn? Are you a U.S. citizen?
So, Nate, what is this anxiety about?
Well, I think a lot of politicians are looking at the census and sort of piling into it all kinds of other political controversies. And so it's not uncommon that issues, for example, of immigration and citizenship then become viewed through the lens of the census, and then also, in this case, fears of the government intrusion. But the census is in the Constitution. It is one of the few obligations of the federal government. So these aren't new processes that the country is going through.
I must interfere for a second. Can Congresswoman Bachman really believe that we can't find, that is anybody in the country that wants to find out how old she is, what her telephone number is, what her gender is, what her race is? Can't find that, for heaven's sakes? Is she really giving the government something that's highly private and confidential?
I'm going to answer that, Ken. No, I think we can Google it.
It's political gamesmanship.
But there is an odd thing about the census survey this year, and that's the categories of race.
Well, they're not different than they were last time, but the census race categories have evolved over time, and they are in some ways politically determined. I mean, the why we count certain people as one thing or another, why we count Hispanics not as a race, for example, is a political decision.
Ken, why do these racial categories seem so strange?
They've been around since 1790 in one way or the other. Subgroups, ethnic groups come and go depending. We counted the Hindus for a while, late 19th century. We counted mulattoes and quadroons and octoroons. Those categories come and go depending upon, as Nate says, the politics of the time and indeed the demographic profile of the time. There are four core race groups in this society, and they've been in this society one way or the other for almost 200 years. They have not changed. I believe they should change.
Can we do race better?
Of course.
How do we do it?
We break the we ask ourselves, why are we doing this? Why are we counting by race? And it turns out there are two separate reasons. One reason is there are lingering, serious disparities across population groups because of discriminatory practices and the legacy of course, slavery, of the treatment of the American Indian, and so forth. In addition, there's a very major question about the assimilation of new Americans, acculturation, assimilation, integration, whatever we want to call it. Very, very important to know whether new immigrants to coming to the country are learning to read, making their way in the labor market, and so forth. We have a single question that's trying to do both of those things, both track assimilation and simultaneously detect discrimination. And I think we ought to ask two separate sets of questions to deal with those different purposes, and they will have different categories.
You know, one of the issues, Nate, with the census each time is that people kind of fudge numbers, or they use census numbers, or maybe try to work the system in a certain way to make their census count come out the way they want to. And we're kind of seeing an example of that in Minnesota. Minnesota is in danger of losing a congressional seat. And so they're asking their retirees, snowbirds who go to Florida, asking them to make sure they fill out their census, listing Minnesota as their address where they are right now. Here's Tom Scheck. He's with Minnesota Public Radio and speaking on this show.
If these snowbirds who live 8-9 months in Minnesota fill out their census form in March or April when they're in Arizona or the other southern state, what they're going to find is that the census is going to be taken, that those folks are going to be recognized in Arizona or Florida, wherever. And what the folks in Minnesota are doing is saying, you know what, don't fill out your census form while you're living there. Wait till you come back during Easter, April, whenever, and then fill it out there, because then you could be counted in Minnesota.
If we can kind of jimmy the system this way, then it's not a true count, is it?
Well, let's think for a second why they're doing this, which is that Minnesota is afraid of losing a congressional seat. So at the last stages of determining representation in Congress, maybe a few thousand people will make a difference. These types of efforts, though, I think you're going to find are not terribly successful. There is a rule, which is where are you on where is your residence on April 1st, 2010? And that is, you know, where the person should count themselves.
Ken Pruitt, what do you think about that? Can the census numbers be kind of jimmied with?
Not easily, for heaven's sakes. The 300 million Americans out there are being counted, some of whom are paying attention, many of whom aren't. No. To try to actually manipulate the fundamental count that gives us our representational process strikes me as a fool's errand.
Ken Pruitt, I mean, you were the director of the census before. Can you kind of speak to all the people out there who are feeling anxious about the census? Maybe they're an illegal immigrant. Maybe they are in prison. Maybe they are a minority. Can you kind of lay some of their fears to rest?
The census, the decennial census for over 200 years has been a nonpartisan, highly professional starting point for what becomes a very intensely partisan outcome, i.e. representation and elections. That is fine. The outcome should be partisan because, after all, we are a democracy. We allow different interests to express their views and to try to send representatives to Washington. The census itself has to be a fair count from the beginning in order to make the political process work well. So I think people who are anxious are not anxious about the census themselves. They're anxious about the outcome. But the only thing I can say to the American people is, for heaven's sakes, let's get it started on the right foot. Let's simply try to count all 300-plus million people who live in this country on April 1st, where they live. And then let the politics use the numbers in ways that make sense in a political process, arguing about how many of this or that or who ought to get what benefits and so forth, all of which is fair game. But it doesn't help anybody for it to get off on the wrong foot. So everybody, for heaven's sakes, nail the form back in.
I'd agree with that and say that, look, either you count or you don't. And if you don't fill out your census form, you won't be counted, and the government won't have information to make decisions. Won't have information to make decisions about health care and all kinds of things about the makeup of the United States. And unless we have accurate census data, we won't really know who lives where.
Well, there you have it. That's Nate Persily, professor of law and politics at Columbia University, also Ken Pruitt. He was the director of the 2000 census. Thanks to both of them for joining us. Hey, later on in this hour, we're going to wrap up our Decade in Review series by looking at some of the most unforgettable pop culture phenomena of the 2000s. Some pop culture you might want to forget.
I was just about to say the exact same thing.
Oh, I stole your thunder.
Sorry. Great minds think alike.
Oh, that's a really positive way to look at it. It's a takeaway. It's The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Well, we've been talking about New Year's resolutions all week, and this is it. It's January 1st. It's time to get going on those resolutions. If you haven't made one, you're late. We're going now to Gretchen Rubin. She's a blogger. She's also author of The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun, which is the longest subtitle perhaps ever. So, Gretchen, you actually made a resolution to become happier.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And that's a complicated thing once you hit the ground. I mean, that includes a lot of different things.
Right, and I ended up making hundreds of different smaller resolutions in order to achieve that big one of being happier.
What? Give me a sampling of some of the smaller ones you had to make.
Well, one of the smallest ones I made was make my bed, and that turned out to be actually quite a happiness booster.
Why?
You know, there's something about starting your day with making your bed. I hear this from people all the time, that making your bed is a great first resolution to make. It's easy, it's quick, it's totally manageable. You do it first thing in the morning. It just makes you a little bit happier.
Okay, actually, that's pretty interesting. Give me another example.
Well, sing in the morning is another one. I think parents of small children, especially, your mornings are completely chaotic and full of nagging and grumbling. And so I decided if I sang in the morning, it would help me be a little bit more cheerful and lighthearted. And in fact, it does have that effect. It's really helpful.
You could kind of branch that out and say, every morning I'm going to have a tiny slice of chocolate cake. You know, anything that would kind of makes you feel up, right?
Well, it depends on your relationship with chocolate cake. I think a lot of people probably are trying to resolve to eat less chocolate cake. So that particular resolution might not lead to more happiness for some people, but it might for you.
What were some of the resolutions that you did to contribute to your overall goal of more happiness that didn't work out?
Well, I tried hypnosis, which I thought might be a very easy, passive shortcut to getting better habits. It turned out it wasn't that easy. It was more like doing a mindfulness meditation for me. I did not find it to be like a super quick fix for, you know, eating healthier or not nagging and that kind of thing. I tried keeping a gratitude journal. Just did not make me feel more grateful. Gave that up. I tried laughter yoga. I felt incredibly self-conscious. It did not make me happy. So those were some of the ones that were less successful.
Well, I mean, were there others in terms of your career or some of the obvious things that made you more happy?
Sure. Well, one of the things I did, because I wanted to do something new and challenging, because that's a great way to make yourself happy, is to do something novel and challenging, is I started my blog. That's why I started it, just to test that premise. And that gave me huge happiness. So that was one thing. Another thing, here's a simple thing. I got three monitors. If you do a lot of information work, I find that having three monitors gives
computer
me a
monitors.
Happiness boost.
You have three computer screens.
Three screens, yeah, exactly.
Right, okay. Wow, well, that's a relatively simple fix if you have the means to buy a couple extra computer screens.
I was amazed, I have to say, in terms of, because having good tools is really good. Like, it's worth the time to sit around and say, like, do I have a good desk chair? Do I have enough light? Do I need new files? You know, whatever. Because good tools make working much more pleasurable and much more satisfying.
So, Gretchen, Ruben, are you happier now?
I am happier. you know, I'm surprised, even though I started this project, I'm surprised by how much of a difference it really did make.
Wow. I guess the takeaway here is it's the little things that end up making you happy. Gretchen Ruben, blogger, author of The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. And it sounds like she was successful. Thanks, Gretchen.
Thank you.
On our website, there's more information about Gretchen Ruben's book and a month-to-month account of how she stuck to her happiness resolution through the whole year at the takeaway. Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee, here for another 15 minutes or so with
Not that
Luke
I am
Burbank.
Counting the time, but I think it's actually
He's
15 minutes.
Ready to go back to beautiful
seconds.
Seattle. I've been sitting in for John Hockenberry, and John returns on Monday. But coming up in just a few minutes, we end our Decade in Review series by looking at some of the most unforgettable pop culture phenomena of the 2000s. Some of them we may now set aside now that the 2000s are over. That's in a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The Iraqi authorities say they're disappointed at the dismissal by a court in the U.S. of charges against five security guards from the Blackwater Company. They were accused of killing unarmed civilians in Baghdad in 2007. The top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, said at a news conference this morning he's concerned the case may lead to a backlash against U.S. contractors.
We all know it was not U.S. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines who did this. It was a private security company. What I worry about is, will there be backlash against private security companies that continue to operate here? And I wouldn't like to see that either.
The judge threw out the case because he said the evidence was not adequate. The Iraqis are calling for a retrial.
Back home, President Barack Obama is wishing for, quote, brighter days ahead in 2010 as he bids the nation a happy new year while on vacation in Hawaii. In a web posting, the president says 2009 was a difficult year for many Americans, but the country rose up and met those challenges.
And a grab bag of new state laws takes effect today. New Hampshire, Oregon, and Illinois join 16 other states that have outlawed texting while driving, and California becomes the first state to partially ban the use of artificial trans fats at restaurants.
It is the first day of 2010, and as we move into this new decade, it's important, Celeste, that we take a moment to look back at our pop culture history from the last decade.
Win this, you stay on the island a few days longer. Lose, you face tomorrow's tribal council where one of you will be the first person voted off the island.
Get you sexy, huh?
I'm not sure it's over for Britney, but is Britney back? 81% said no.
Tiger always gives 110%. That's why he gave 100% to his wife and still had 10% left over for his mistress.
So thank you so much for giving me a chance to win a VMA award.
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Have you seen this new reality show called The Jersey Shore on MTV?
I like Italian boys with muscles.
What can you possibly say to somebody that looks like Rambo pretty much with his shirt off?
We've got to look back. We've got to look back on our pop culture history, because if we forget it, we might be doomed to repeat it, Celeste. And some of it,
that's true.
It may be not. Well, let's just get some people in here who know about it. Patrick Henry Bass, books editor for Essence Magazine, and Kate Daly, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you for having me.
Great to be here.
Patrick, let's start with that most ephemeral, most shame-making brand of pop culture. Of course, we speak of reality TV. Who knew it would still be around 10 years later and in a lot of ways even bigger than ever?
I have two words for you, Susan Boyle. Who would have thunk that a frumpy, and there's no one who loves a frump more than I do, a frumpy 48-year-old Scottish woman could go on a British reality show, draw more than 100 million people to watch that British reality show.
Right.
She releases a CD in the United States and beats Lady Gaga, Rihanna, and Adam Lambert, who came from American Idol. 10 years later, we still have these words in our mouths, and not to my happiness, Paris Hilton, who started on the reality show Simple Life. Reality television won't go away. And the disturbing part about it is it's only gaining traction. It's not we're seeing no signs of reality shows slowing down.
Kate, you've been on this very radio program talking about reality TV. In your professional opinion, how long before Americans tire of this sort of awesome discourse?
So then I was looking around for, like, Ronnie, and then I see him on the dance floor with another girl. I'm not trying to, like, be played out. If I see you physically on the dance floor with another girl, like, then forget you.
Oh, Ronnie. That, of course, is from the TV show/phenomenon Jersey Shore. Kate, I mean, is there going to be a point when we ever, as a society, as Americans, get over this reality TV?
You know, just when you think we've hit our lowest point, we managed to go a little bit lower.
We turned the barrel over and actually scrape below the bottom of the barrel.
Yes, and 2009 was a big year for barrel scraping in reality TV. So you would think that maybe this would bring kind of the whole reality phenomenon to a close. You had Balloon Boy, whose family cost the government something like $40,000 because they were trying to get a reality show. You had people crashing the White House because they wanted to get on a reality show. And then you have, you know, the cultural train wreck that is Jersey Shore. So if anything is going to get people to give up reality TV, you would think that those things had happened. But it's so cheap to produce and it's so much fun to watch that I have a feeling it's not going anywhere soon.
Okay, switching to movies. Patrick, how did the film industry evolve during the last decade, you think?
It's interesting because it started out with great hope for indies and it ended with blockbusters, and I would say that that had more to do with the economy than it did the quality of the offerings from independent studios. So you started the decade with movies like Brokeback Mountain and Chicago, which, you know, revitalized the movie musical, and you end this week with the largest box office receipts in the history of Hollywood during Christmas holiday.
Kate, what interested you about film's evolution in the 2000s?
Well, one of the things that was encouraging for me to see is it seems like there's a lot more participation from women filmmakers at the end of the decade than there was at the beginning. Of course, when you say more participation, that goes from something like 7% female directors to maybe 14% female directors, so it's still a much smaller pool. But you're seeing people like Nancy Myers have a lot more creative control. You're seeing Kathryn Bigelow make films like The Hurt Locker, which many people are saying are the best picture of the year. So from a back-end standpoint, from people who are actually making creative choices, directing, producing, writing, you're seeing more women involved, which is encouraging for me.
Okay, we started with reality TV, and then we went to movies. We're slowly making our way up the classiness ladder. Let's get seriously classy and talk about literature. Patrick, you're the books editor at Essence. What's your sense of whether Americans have changed their approach to buying and reading books in the 2000s?
Well, I was encouraged, if you look back at the decade, to see careers like Dave Eggers and Zadie Smith, and to see Ian McEwan do a novel like Atonement, which was accessible and quite beautiful and layered and nuanced. So I think what we're probably going to start to see, because of the conglomerization of publishing, we're going to see less and less authors. And so the authors that are published are going to be more specialized type authors. And authors like Dave Eggers, the next generation of those authors, are going to have to find their readers through social networking like Facebook and Twittering and those types of methods. It won't be through the traditional review media like Essence Magazine and Newsweek.
Okay, I have a question for both of you. Maybe you guys can settle an argument that we're having in the control room. Okay, Kate Daly, Patrick Henry Bass, looking back at the 10 years, keeping in mind where they both started in like 1999 and where they are now, who had the worst decade? Britney Spears or Tiger Woods?
Tiger Woods.
Really?
Yes. I'm going to go with Britney Spears.
Okay.
I think if you're looking at the decade.
Yeah, the whole decade.
Britney started out at the top, and it's, you know, she gained some weight, she had some kids, she hit some cars with some umbrellas. It was not, you know, not a banner year for Britney. I think she's on the upswing, but collectively, I think Tiger still got all that money.
We have an entire century for more bimbos to go on television and say that they slept with Tiger Woods.
You know, yeah, but Britney Spears is not one of them. To her credit.
That we know of yet. That we know of yet, Luke.
All right. If those rumors start to foment, it will be, of course, on the internets. Let me ask quickly, Kate and Patrick, before we leave. Of the internet memes and phenomenons that popped up in the 2000s, what's the one that you're not sick of that you're still watching and enjoying, Patrick?
YouTube for me.
Kate, how about you?
I'm a big fan of podcasts. They really changed the way that I listen to stuff.
I have to say that the one that I still find myself returning to a disturbing number of times would be Tay Zonday's classic hit Chocolate Rain, featured on YouTube, and I guess you could listen to it as a podcast, possibly. So it's only fitting we go out with that today. First, though, a big thanks, Kate Daly, health and lifestyle editor at Newsweek, and Patrick Henry Bass, books editor at Essence.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Chocolate rain. Some stay dry and others feel the pain. Chocolate rain.
You're welcome, Celeste. That'll
it's
be
in
your
head. It's
going
to be stuck in my head. I'm going to start 2010 with chocolate rain
It'll
stuck in my
head.
It'll
just be your little
it's
friend.
It's not auspicious.
It'll be your little earworm that lives in your head all weekend.
Yeah, thanks.
Today is January 1st, and from everyone here at The Takeaway, we would just like to wish you and your families a very safe and very happy New Year. As you are wrapping up your celebrations and now thinking about making those New Year's resolutions stick, do you have any tricks of the trade? And if so, could you tell us about them? We need them. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, it's been an auspicious week, Luke Burbank. You've been with me all week long, filling in for John Hockenberry. John returns on Monday.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say thank you. It's been a real pleasure sitting across the table from you.
Thank you, Celeste. Parting is such sweet sorrow. And by the way, to the whole staff of The Takeaway, you guys are a crack
They're
squad.
Top notch,
amazing,
aren't they?
Amazing
if
stuff.
If you want to keep up with Luke Burbank, you can subscribe to his Too Beautiful to Live podcast.
Yes.
At iTunes. You can also at iTunes, by the way,
yeah.
subscribe to
there.
The Takeaway podcast. You might as well.
Sure.
Or at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I've been Luke Burbank. This is The Takeaway.
Quickly crashing through your veins, chocolate rain. Using you to fall back down again, chocolate rain. Seldom mentioned on the radio, chocolate rain.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.